We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing whether or not there will be an Edward R. Murrow moment soon with Donald Trump. Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the worst mass shooting in U.S. history that just took place at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida, which has left 50 dead and 53 wounded. Congressman Alan Grayson, who represents Florida's 8th Congressional District, which includes Orlando, joins us. We'll discuss what has been termed an act of domestic terrorism and look into the long night of terror in the popular gay bar and dance club, The Pulse, after the first round of gunfire at 2 a.m., then the shooter took hostages for 3 hours before a police SWAT team stormed the nightclub and killed Omar Sadiq Martin, a 29-year-old American of Afghan descent, who local law enforcement officials are saying had declared his allegiance to ISIS. Then we'll discuss further the foreign connections and influences on the shooter from ISIS, and in particular Wahhabi Islam, an extreme religious ideology that embraces takfir, a religious exemption and exhortation to kill in the name of Islam that the Saudi government has proliferated around the world, fueled by endless petrodollars, which has spawned the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, and the self-declared Islamic State. Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation, joins us to discuss the peculiar priorities of the U.S. government in insisting countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan are allies when terrorist incident after terrorist incident reveals the clear connections to these states and the fingerprints of Wahhabism as the inspiration and motivation for these acts of terror. Then finally, we will speak with Edward Schumacher Matos, the director of the Edward R. Murrow Center at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He joins us to discuss whether and when there will be an Edward R. Murrow moment for Donald Trump in this presidential campaign, as there was when a right-wing populist Republican Senator Joe McCarthy was finally called out by Murrow after he had run roughshod over democratic values, the rule of law, civility, and decency, all in the name of cleansing America and purging it of un-American activities. And joining us now from Orlando, Florida, is Congressman Alan Grayson, a Democrat who serves in Florida's 8th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives and is a member of the Foreign Affairs and Science, Space, and Technology Committees. As a congressman, Alan Grayson received significant attention for his strong stance on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and holding politicians and bankers accountable. Welcome to Background Briefing, Congressman Alan Grayson.
Thank you.
And obviously, Congressman, the worst possible conditions to be having a discussion. It's in your district, and it's been a hideous long night, and starting at 2 a.m. with the first shots fired, and then hostages being held for 3 hours, and then finally the SWAT police SWAT team storming in at about 5 a.m., and now there are, of course, reports coming in of connections, as we just discussed, to ISIS, and the FBI apparently have looked into this shooter. What's the latest information you have on what might have influenced this person to do what he did?
Well, according to social media, he self-identified as a Muslim. There's a picture of him wearing a Muslim skull cap. His parents are from Afghanistan, but I want to point out that there are literally millions upon millions of people in the United States who meet that exact description who don't go and kill 50 people. Also, he did take it upon himself to drive almost 2 hours from Port St. Lucie to Orlando. I think it's no coincidence that he picked out a gay nightclub in order to wreak havoc. There's an interview that was done with his father earlier today where his father said that he was very upset to see two men kissing in public recently. So it appears that he committed a premeditated hate crime toward the gay community. That's what we know at this point.
But there's, it's not as if those members of the Islamic State or those people influenced to become jihadists are not religiously intolerant, because by definition, Saudi Wahhabism, which is the religious ideology that informs them, is about as intolerant, if not the most intolerant religion on the planet, and certainly that kind of homophobia is quite common, along with the, you know, the oppression of women, etc. So I guess it's hard to distinguish between the two, is it not?
Well, I understand what you're saying, and there is plenty of support for the view that Wahhabists hate homosexuals. I'm not going to dispute that. We've had instances of ISIS members throwing people thought gay off of eight-story buildings to their death. Nevertheless, I want to talk about what actually happened today, which is one person with one weapon committing a very heinous act. If there's any larger meaning here, I would tend to think it comes from the fact that one person can kill 50 people in a matter of minutes with one weapon. And there are almost 4 million of those weapons spread throughout the United States, and they're banned in only 6 states. So if we're looking for a greater meaning here, I don't think we're going to be able to wipe radical Islam from the minds of millions of adherents anytime soon. I don't think we're going to be able to create some kind of reconciliation between religious fanatics and the gay community. But I do think we can do many constructive things to try to make sure that people who do have those impulses can't act on them in the way that he did today and kill 50 people in a matter of minutes.
So, of course, without appearing to be cynical, Congressman Grayson, that was very much the opinion of many people. In fact, the majority of people in this country after the Sandy Hook shooting, which was an extraordinarily heinous act against kindergarten children, and it upset a lot of people, including the President of the United States. And yet, at the end of the day, the Congress couldn't act. You're in Congress. Do you think that there's a threshold here that has been crossed that may somehow loosen the grip of the NRA over so many members of Congress?
Well, I think those of us who have any sort of open mind, any grip on reality, recognize that it's much too easy to kill a lot of people very quickly, and that something needs to be done about that. But you're absolutely right that the NRA has a very iron grip over the dominant party in the House of Representatives, the Republican Party, and that we haven't even seen in a vote on anything that would restrict this kind of weaponry, these weapons of mass destruction, since the Republicans took over the House of Representatives several years ago. Frankly, nor are we likely to see it anytime soon. But I do want to point out that after the Sandy Hook tragedy, which was the second worst shooting in the United States history until this morning, now the third worst shooting in the United States history, since this was the first, right after that, or not long after that, there were 3 states who prohibited this weapon within their borders and resurrected the assault weapon ban that we had in place throughout the United States for several years until the NRA took it down. So those children did not die in vain. Connecticut and 2 other states passed legislation to prohibit these weapons and prevent this tragedy at Sandy Hook from ever happening again. Maybe we'll see the same kind of result here. I certainly think that it's very much on people's minds, and certainly will never be forgotten by anybody here in Orlando anytime soon.
And is there evidence? I know it's early in terms of forensics, but one would think with the high-powered assault rifle, I believe it was the civilian version of the M16 that the military uses, the AR-15, those bullets can go a long way, right? And it's possible with that high number of casualties that one bullet may have struck more than one person?
Well, not only that, that's a weapon that in its automatic form can shoot 700 rounds in a minute. So do the math. It may have taken less than a minute to kill those 50 people. That's intolerable. Now, the gun is sold in the 44 states where it's still legal. in its semi-automatic form, where you actually have to pull the trigger each time in order to fire it. But that's something that can be done almost 200 times in the course of a minute with an average person of average dexterity. So you can get off 200 shots as long as you have enough magazines with you. It's illegal to sell magazines in this country for that weapon that have more than 30 rounds in them. But that just means that you can kill 30 people very quickly in a matter of seconds before you have to reload. This gun has no conceivable recreational use. And you scratch your head and you wonder why we allow that kind of weapon to be sold. That's a weapon of mass destruction. You can kill countless people in a very short period of time. Ironically, the NRA refers to this weapon as the musket of today. Well, if you are really good at it, you can get off 3 rounds with a musket in a minute. But with this weapon in its automatic form, and you can transfer it to automatic form with information you can Google, it's not that difficult to actually alter it so that it fires automatically. In that case, you can get off more than 700 rounds in a single minute and conceivably kill 700 people before they have any chance of running away.
Well, I recall that after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan in response to the 9/11 attacks, there was a massive cache of documents and information from al-Qaeda that were captured. And among them was the al-Qaeda handbook that recommended its jihadis, if they go to the United States, do not take weapons in with you. You can buy them off the shelf in the United States. And again, that feels like a terrible indictment of our dysfunction, that we are a country that has the best armed criminals and terrorists in the world with absolutely free access to military-style weapons. Again, I know we as a nation, we're quite patriotic and we spend an awful lot of money on defense. Is there a way to sort of turn on our brains and recognize the dysfunction that we're aiding and abetting the enemy in effect because of our lax or non-existent gun control or gun safety as it's now being, referred to in a more semantically useful way?
Well, all you have to do is look outside of our borders. There's a tiny, tiny number of countries around the world that have even 100 gun murders every year, and we have 10,000 plus. So I think that speaks to this issue more eloquently than anything else that I can say. The fact of the matter is that it's all too easy to kill a lot of people quickly. And the only reason why that's true is because we allow that to happen. We allow these guns to be sold freely. The last time I looked, I don't know if this is still true or not, the last time I looked, you could buy this AR-15 weapon in Walmart.
Well, just in closing, Congressman Grayson, what's your sense then of how the there were obviously a lot of quarterbacking, or Monday morning quarterbacking, as they call it, will go on about how long it took, et cetera, and why there was this gap between 2 a.m. and 5 p.m., 5 a.m. But the long and the short of it is that, as you've pointed out, and as is clear, you can't either predict or prevent these things, and the only reasonable thing you can do is take away the means for massacring people, which are these automatic weapons. But as a community, I take it that you've all got to be in shock. What do you expect in terms of the next couple of days, and just in terms of the local community, as opposed to the broader national debate that we've been discussing that the country sorely needs?
Well, one of the questions I get asked over and over again is, was this an act of terror? Was this terrorism? And I have to say yes, because that's how people feel. People recognize that 50 people minding their own business, just trying to have a good night out, got killed. And the whole purpose of civilization is to protect us from that, to give us some kind of sense of personal safety that we can build on in order to build a good life. And 50 people were robbed of that for no reason at 2 a.m. this morning. Entirely innocent people, non-combatants in every sense of the word. And the result of that is that people feel a tremendous amount of unease, and you could even call it terror. I hope that that dampens down over time. But I know that whether or not you happen to know any of these 50 people who died or the 50-plus who were injured, whether you know them personally or not, you feel like maybe you're unsafe. And in that sense, it's very much terrorism. I hope that people, we can do something to make sure that something like this never happens again. There are some obvious answers that we've already discussed.
Well, Congressman Grayson, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it, and I'm sorry that it has to be under these conditions.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Congressman Alan Grayson, who's a Democrat who serves in Florida's 8th District, 8th Congressional District in the House of Representatives, and is a member of the Foreign Affairs and Science, Space, and Technology Committees. As a congressman, Alan Grayson received significant attention for his strong stances on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and holding politicians and bankers accountable. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into foreign connections and influences on the shooter from ISIS and Wahhabi Islam. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the co-author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
And I was wanting to sort of talk to you about some of the crazy stuff that's going on with Donald Trump and with the Republican Party. And this Tea Party congressman from Texas, Louie Gohmert, took to the floor the other day. Apparently he had seen the movie with Matt Damon, The Martian, and railed against the idea of gay colonies on Mars. And he's one of the leading Republicans that seem to be obsessed with bathrooms. But frankly, given what's just happened in Orlando, none of this is particularly funny, is it? I mean, there is a direct relationship, I think, between the homophobic motivations of the shooter and the kind of stuff that our lawmakers, particularly on the Republican side, are spouting out in public.
No, I disagree. I don't think there's any connection. I think what you have is we need to honestly, you know, talk about what the problem with a Wahhabi Salafist terrorism is. Mm-hmm. It's not Islam as such. It's not even Islamism, because there are different kinds of Islamist parties. It's Wahhabi Salafism. And this is a highly developed ideology. It's extremely intelligent and coherent, you know, within frame of reference. And these terrorist assaults that are being carried out, and they're not generic Muslims, they're Salafists. We need to say Salafists. They're Salafist jihadists. They've carried them out in India, in France, in San Bernardino, in Orlando, in London. And I don't think it doesn't matter
right
what the politics of the country are. You know, this is, and it's not Islam versus the rest of the world. It is this attempted revolution of Salafist Wahhabism, which is an extreme form of Islam promoted by Saudi Arabia. So it's not even typical of Islam in many other countries. But I wouldn't connect it to, you know, anything other than what it is. This is a global revolutionary ideology of the right. It's right wing.
Right. Well, I guess Wahhabism is probably the least tolerant, most xenophobic, most hostile, paranoid religion on the planet. And takfirism, which is the sanction to kill others, is at the heart of what is sick around the world. But so, but do we know, for example, that this nightclub shooter, Omar Siddiqui Mateen, an American born of Afghan heritage, has the connection been satisfactorily made that just like the Taliban, which was financed and inspired by the Saudis?
Right, it's just been reported. But the scary thing is, as my colleague Peter Bergen, who interviewed Osama bin Laden back in the 90s, long before the 9/11 attacks, as he pointed out, it has morphed from an organization, Al-Qaeda or even ISIS, into a movement. And so in the same sense that, Lee Harvey Oswald called himself a Marxist, and, you know, he was like a lone shooter, but what the ideology that was driving him was, in his own mind, he was a Marxist revolutionary, killing Kennedy on behalf of Castro and in the global communist revolution. That's the scary thing, where you see, you know, since it's an ideology, you can have people who are not necessarily connected to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or any of these networks, but they pick it up and then they act on their own. But we'll have to see what the situation is here.
Well, but for the longest time, it's been apparent that Saudi Arabia, and it's the compact that the House of Saud has with the Wahhabis, is a very toxic one, to say the least, and that they have ostensibly an American ally. At the same time, through their petrodollars, they've been exporting around the world this violent and hateful religious ideology, and they've spawned the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Al-Nusra, the Islamic State, Daesh, Boko Haram, and the list goes on. But yet, for example, just yesterday, the head of the CIA, Brennan, speaking in the Gulf, said that the 28 pages of the report from the Joint Congressional Committee looking into 9/11 that was chaired by Senator Bob Graham of Florida, that there is no Saudi connection and that the Saudis are completely innocent. And it's just extraordinary to me that the level of denial, not seeing this obvious connection that's been going on now for decades. Why do we make, obviously the simple answer is oil, but why do we continue to propagate this fiction that somehow Saudi Arabia is not connected to what this jihadism that's been besetting the world?
Well, I think partly it's because Saudi Arabia is not a state in the Weberian sense, that is, an impersonal bureaucracy that has a corporate existence apart from the rulers. It really is a family. I mean, it's a medieval kingdom. And so I just think the question is, I'll push back against your question. If it's, medieval, Henry VIII or something, you don't talk about the English state. It's Henry VIII, right? Mm-hmm. And it's quite conceivable that Henry VIII's cousins are plotting to depose him. So what seems to have gone on, and Osama bin Laden, of course, was part of the Saudi elite, is this civil war. It's almost like a dynastic war within Saudi elite in this insecure kingdom. And to worsen everything, Saudis, as you point out, have this bargain with the clerics because they're afraid of being overthrown by the population egged on by the radical Wahhabist clerics. So, and from the U.S. point of view, I'm not defending it. I think we've indulged Saudi Arabia far too long. But there's the natural belief that, to quote Hilaire Belloc, it's always best to cling to nurse for fear of finding something worse. So the idea is that if you push too hard on the Saudis, then they could fall, and then you would get even more extreme, sort of fundamentalists coming to power. Now, as we saw in the Cold War, this lets bad regimes get away with a whole lot because they can always say, well, you may not like us, but the alternative is worse.
Well, but for example, the Soviet Union was a bad regime, but one of the reasons it's collapsed was and it's the backlash to the Soviet regime is a sort of this, you know, gangster capitalism we have there today. But you also, by the time it collapsed, particularly the young Russians absolutely despised the system. And there's a lot of evidence that the young people in Saudi Arabia who living under these ridiculous and oppressive religious strictures hate the regime and are all connected to the world through social media, etc. And so it's not a given that if there was a revolution in Saudi Arabia, it would necessarily, that the Wahhabis would triumph.
No, it may not be. But, you know, there's also the question, is there a Saudi people, or is this something like the Habsburg dynasty or the United Kingdom, which seems to be, you know, on the verge of crack up, perhaps, once again? Right. Is this something that's simply held together by a royal family? And what you see in the entire neighborhood of Saudi Arabia is these states do not correspond to actual populations. And they're disintegrating into ethnic enclaves, whether it's the Sunnis of ISIS in eastern Syria and western Iraq, the Kurds, and so on. So, I think there's a real danger that conservatives will react again to terrorism by treating this as conventional warfare, where we go blow things up. And there's a danger that progressives, I think, respond to it as it's like an inner city riot or something, you know, that the problem is, you know, lack of economic opportunity or alienation or something like that. I do think that there are certain ideologies which have to be taken seriously, you know, like communism and national socialism and Wahhabism. And, you know, it's not a matter of relative deprivation, because in many cases, the leaders and many of the followers come from fairly well-educated middle-class backgrounds. And I don't think either the warfare metaphor or the economic deprivation metaphor really captures this.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who is the co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His latest book is Land of Promise and Economic History of the United States. So Omar Siddiqui Mateen, according to his father, was outraged that he was out with his wife and his three-year-old son in public in Miami, and they ran into a couple of young men kissing, and that set him off. There is, of course, an obvious connection between religious intolerance and homophobia, and the Wahhabis are certainly, they are amongst the most intolerant of all religious sects on the planet.
Well, that's right. But see, the parallel is with fundamentalist Christians. If you say that abortion is murder, and that doctors performing abortions are the equivalent of, you know, abortion clinics are like the Nazi death camps, well, then people are going to take you, some individual is going to take you at your word and try to shut this down, you know, through murder or blowing up abortion clinics. So, you know, fundamentally, I don't think that you can have a stable balance between saying these things or teaching them and then saying, oh, but we don't want we don't want you to be violent. Because if there actually were death camps in the United States, the moral thing to do would be to try to overthrow the government or at least try to shut them down, right? Yeah. So I think it's a real serious problem, you know, for a liberal society. If you have groups, Christian or Muslim, or they could be secular, teaching that things are that are accepted practices by most citizens are, you know, evils that God wants you to put a stop to, or that, you know, that are just absolute evils that violate justifying the law. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, in the case of the Protestant fundamentalists, this problem is going away, because younger generations are losing interest in Christianity in the United States, particularly in the fundamentalist form. It's just losing younger generations. And maybe something like that will happen with these intolerant forms of Islam in the West, or its own homelands.
Well, indeed, the Southern Baptist Convention just announced that for the last 9 years, their numbers have been going down. they've been losing their flock. So the statistics bear that out, Michael Lynn. But of course, when you mention the abortion situation where somebody can go into a church and murder a doctor, which happened a while back, what I find scary about all of these things, and takfir by definition, is a moral exemption, a moral free ride to go after a greater evil. And I see that connection extraordinarily clearly. But for example, after 9/11, many people that I talked to in the intelligence and defense world, you know, sardonically said, you know, we went after the wrong people. We went after Iraq and Afghanistan instead of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. So why do we have, I mean, I understand the structures in our foreign policy, but why do we keep throwing good money after bad and good policy after bad in believing somehow that that these countries are our friends when the evidence is clear that they're our enemies, or at least they're stabbing us in the back?
Well, I think that's a very good question, you know, arguably the real axis of evil is Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, or at least the anti-American elements in their military and their intelligence services. And, you know, the U.S. government continues to insist, along with the Pakistani government, that the Pakistanis didn't know that Osama bin Laden was living next to the, you know, Pakistani military base, which is, you know, who knows what the situation is, but that's somewhat hard to believe. You know, yeah, I think I don't think it's any great, you know, conspiracy or anything like that. It's just inertia. That is, in the Cold War, Pakistan was our ally because India was tilted towards the Soviets. And also, obviously, it helped us in Afghanistan, you know, during the Afghan War against the Soviets. And the same is true of the Saudis. And the problem is the American foreign policy elite has not used the last three decades as an opportunity to reconsider who is an ally and who is an enemy. So if you look at everything that's going around in the world today, the U.S. is essentially doubling down on its Cold War alliances, whether it's in East Asia against China or in Europe against the Russians or in the Gulf against the Iranians, notwithstanding the nuclear deal. And no one is asking, well, is Iran really necessarily our major enemy compared to, say, Turkey, which is fomenting, you know, Sunni jihadism in the region? Is Russia, do we really have fewer values in common with Putin's Russia than with Erdogan's Turkey? And these questions aren't being asked by the bipartisan foreign policy establishment. I don't think they will be asked, because there's such an element of groupthink that if you deviate from the consensus, then you're marginalized within the establishment.
Well, but I just wonder at what point, Michael Lynn, the evidence is so overwhelming that it somehow can swamp the denial. For example, recently, Carletta Gall in the New York Times wrote a series of articles about what's happening in Kosovo, which was liberated by the United States. And at the time, there was a lot of talk about how the United States rescued European Muslims from murderous Christian Serbs. And guess what happened? No sooner did the U.S. create this state, give it independence, the Saudis moved in, built Wahhabi mosques, brought their preachers in, and now Kosovo is the number one contributor of European jihadis. And more recently, with the terrorist acts in Belgium, we then learned that the main mosque that from which these killers were recruited had a Saudi imam and was financed by the Saudis. So the fingerprints are just sort of so clear. It's just extraordinary that, and now you've got Orlando. So,
here's the tough question. So Americans of mainstream Americans, Democrats or Republicans, are for more democracy. They're for free elections, right? So, you know, we're in general against getting rid of autocrats and replacing them with Democrats. But what happens if the free elections, if the voters actually are dominated by clerics? Right now, Thomas Jefferson and the founders thought this through. Jefferson said, you know, very anti-Catholic, like many 18th century Protestants, you could not have a republic in a priest-ridden country, right? But so there are two ways you can get a theocracy. One way is that the clerics rule themselves directly. They have some role in government, as in Iran. The indirect form of theocracy, which we have had, particularly at times in the southern states in the United States, is you have free elections, but the priests or the preachers or the rabbis or whoever tell their flocks how to vote, and their politicians who are elected try to build a society on the basis of this or that religious doctrine. And I don't think that Americans thought this through. Going back to the 90s and the Balkans, to Bush and Iraq and so on, and in Egypt, right? So you get rid of Mubarak, a dictator, and then you get the Muslim Brotherhood, which, you know, then starts, and what you see now is a result of greater democratic elections in Turkey is the parties are becoming more Islamist. And this is something that makes Americans very uncomfortable, because it implies that you have to choose maybe between secularism and democracy in some cases, or between a moderate amount of civil liberties under an authoritarian ruler or none at all under a popularly elected religious regime.
Well, all the more reason, I think, to draw attention to the obvious parallels between fundamentalism around the world, whether it's Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, or Muslim.
Well, yes and no. I think if you look at Jewish and Hindu fundamentalism, these are more or less ethnic religions. They're not proselytizing religions. They don't have people, essentially they're hereditary. So it's essentially about ethnic identity. I think Christianity and Islam, there is a parallel, because these, by their nature, are multi-ethnic, global, or potentially global religions. You can be Muslim or Christian, come from any race, any ethnic background, although obviously you tend to inherit from your parents, but it's not necessary. You can have conversion. And that's what makes it a battle of ideas, not just with other religions, but with secular modernity, in the sense that, you know, very few people who are not Hindu are going to convert to Hinduism, but you see the appeal, you know, to some people. There are converts to Islam from other backgrounds. You know, obviously Christianity is a proselytizing religion. And what you find if you look at the data about membership is the more liberal denominations tend to lose their members the fastest. And the ones that tend to last longer are the more orthodox, dogmatic ones. Because one of the reasons people turn to religion is they want absolute certainty. So even in a modern society, there are people, they want to be told there's this one law, this one set of rules handed down by God, and that has a lot of appeal.
Well, just in closing, Michael Lind, you mentioned autocrats, and of course a lot of comments have been made about Donald Trump having autocratic tendencies. And in fact, at Mitt Romney's retreat over this weekend, Meg Whitman, the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, likened Donald Trump to a Hitler or a Mussolini. And will this play into this Orlando massacre, which is the worst shooting in U.S. history, a mass casualty event in U.S. history? Will that play into Trump's hands?
Well, to begin with, he's not Hitler or Mussolini. He's more like Hulk Hogan. You know, the latest is he wants to get, you know, ultimate fighting champions and other sports heroes instead of politicians at the Republican convention.
Right. So, I know he went off. He went off about the basketball coach, and I mean, the more they see him, the less there is, you know.
Yeah, so if he has his own SS, they're going to be wearing, like, colorful wrestling ties. it could. I think my suspicion is both sides can neutralize this, because both sides are right, in a sense. That is, the right can say, well, there should have been more intelligence, you know, more surveillance, if this guy turns out to you know, have had contact with you know, Wahhabist, you know, radicals. On the other hand, the liberals quite rightly can say, well, even if you're a Wahhabist radical, if you can't buy vast amounts of ammunition legally in the United States and stockpile weapons, what are you going to do? You can't knife 50 people. Knife a few people before you're caught or stopped. But I think probably both sides will spin this their own way. And I think it will probably be a wash, kind of like the San Bernardino massacre.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Sorry, such a grim topic of conversation.
Yeah, indeed. But we'll catch up again.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He is the co-author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy, What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing whether or not there will be an Edward R. Murrow moment soon with Donald Trump.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Edward Shoemaker Matos, who's the director of the Edward R. Murrow Center for a Digital World, a professor of digital media and public diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and a global fellow at the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's a former ombudsman at NPR, and he was part of a team to win the Pulitzer Prize at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Shoemaker Matos.
Hi, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And Edward, in terms of an Edward R. Murrow moment, which there have been some suggestions that Donald Trump may have his Edward R. Murrow moment. Just to put that moment in context, it was during the Cold War that Senator Joe McCarthy had gained national prominence, suggesting that there were communists in the government, in the military, and in effect under everyone's bed. And this was a period of great paranoia since the Soviets had just let off the atom bomb, etc., and U.S. had lost its monopoly on nuclear weapons. But in general, there is a sort of, I guess, a fairly obvious analogy between McCarthy and Trump, in as much as they're both Republicans, or nominally, in Donald Trump's case. I think they're examples of right-wing populism. But in a sense, when Murrow called out McCarthy after he'd run roughshod over democratic values, the rule of law, civility, and decency, all in the name of cleansing America and purging it of un-American activities, some of that certainly feels like that resonates in terms of what Trump is doing.
It does. Sadly, I do think that Trump, like McCarthy, is a danger for America. I don't know if we'll see an Edward R. Murrow moment, in part because we don't have any one television network or TV show that has the kind of impact and is so broadly followed today like it was back in 1954 when Edward R. Murrow did his half-hour See It Now show on McCarthy. And then had McCarthy actually back on air 3 weeks later, live for another show, which McCarthy tried to defend himself, and Murrow just confronted him directly on the facts, and McCarthy flopped for all the American public to see, And you can argue that that was the beginning of the end of McCarthy. But we just don't have any one show or any one network that has that kind of following today. The old pipeline model of news was controlled by then just three television networks and by the government has been replaced by a network model with information coming from all sides and all people. So we might have something. Somebody may pull something together or Trump may appear on some show that will be like the second show between Merrill and McCarthy and lead to his demise. But I don't know. We'll have to wait to see.
Well, I suppose the fundamental difference, as you pointed out, Edward, is that it was in effect incredibly highly rated. And Murrow, I guess, was CBS News was the highest rated and in many ways created the kind of format for network and television news. Now it's dissipated. You've got 24-hour cable. People do their own ideological shopping, liberals for MSNBC, conservatives for Fox, etc. So you're not going to change too many minds. And perhaps what's happening to us all, we're just getting too much unfiltered information. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
No, I think that is a reasonable conclusion. I mean, much has been made about all the media attention that Trump has gotten and how he's lived off of free television exposure. He's been brilliant at exploiting the way the media is structured today, both online and in television, not in print. I mean, he has not gotten the favorable kind of trouble coverage in print that people complain about when it comes to TV. But Trump is so good about, he calls into shows himself. And, if you're an anchor or you're the showrunner on a show and you get called by Donald Trump, a candidate for president, and, seeming candidate for the Republican Party, how do you say, no, I don't want to talk to you? That's a hard thing to do. Now, some anchors have been pushing back, which is good, but it's taken a long time to adjust. And, the networks have made money off of Trump. There's no doubt about it. But that's not the driving thing here. The driving thing here is Trump's ability to exploit the media, particularly TV, and then his ability to get his own message out directly through social media.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Schumacher Martas, who is the director of the Edward R. Murrow Center for a Digital World, a professor of digital media and public diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and a global fellow at the Latin America program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's the former ombudsman for NPR and was a part of a team to win the Pulitzer Prize at the Philadelphia Inquirer. So I suppose another analogy might be, Edward, that there is Senator McCarthy was a kind of one-trick pony, which was, are you not a communist? And he kept sort of promising these lists. I think at one point he held up his dry cleaning bill, I believe, and was posing as a list of communists. Eventually it was revealed that the emperor had no clothes, and he was just, the repetition got to be hollow. And frankly, I was watching Donald Trump at a rally in Virginia on Friday, where again, the rhetoric is hollow. He's all over the place. It's not the same as the kind of reality TV show that he ran throughout the primaries, where he knocked the 16 of the other candidates one by one off the island like it was a reality show. And that was his forte, if you will. Now that he's out there on his own, I think in a way, the more you see him, the less there is. It may not be so much as an Edward R. Murrow moment that does him in. It may well be like the scene in The Wizard of Oz at the end when they pull back the curtain as this sort of terrified old man.
I mean, I know that Meg Whitman compared him to Hitler or Mussolini. I think he's more like Mussolini. Sometimes I've wondered whether or not Hillary Clinton should just refer to him as Mussolini. in somewhat the same way he refers to Senator Warren as Pocahontas, because really he is a characterization. He is a personality. He's not running on any kind of a real platform. He has no facts to offer. He doesn't know policy. He's really selling himself, and he's selling an image. And you're right. There's nothing behind that image. And you know, he really reminds me more of Mussolini than anybody else. And that's what makes him so dangerous. I mean, it's that ability to play on populist resentments that have nothing to do with reality is very dangerous.
Well, there's, of course, the right-wing talk show host in Wisconsin, who's very popular, and it's worth noting that Wisconsin was the only, I think, about the only primary that Trump lost, was largely because of Charlie Sykes. And Charlie Sykes refers to Donald Trump as the Orange Duce, which is kind of...
I mean, I think in Trump's case, it's a little bit, you know, you live by the sword and he's going to die by the sword. Right. I just think that, as you say, that now that we get to a two-person race, it's going to be more and more apparent that he has nothing to back him up, and this is going to be a disaster for the Republican Party.
Well, it already is, just in terms of the headlines that keep coming out of various important Republicans either distancing themselves or criticizing Trump, or, you know, sort of somehow wringing their hands and hoping that he will stop what he's doing and get on message, as Mitch McConnell says. But I don't think you can let these senior Republicans off the hook, particularly Mitch McConnell. After all, he is preventing President Obama's Supreme Court nominee from even getting a hearing. And he's arguing that I'm doing this because I want the American people I want the next president who will, in terms of McConnell's party, would be Donald Trump. I want him to have the pick. So how can you criticize Donald Trump on the one hand and on the other hand say he's the guy that's going to pick our next Supreme Court justice?
Yes, the Republicans have a problem. You can see that they're all squirming and not knowing what to do. Coming back to the news media, I'm happy to see that more and more news media are trying to do immediate fact checking on the things that he says and the things that Hillary Clinton says too. I think that's good. How much influence that's going to have remains to be seen, because, you know, unfortunately, the people who support Trump just don't even believe the fact checkers.
Well, that's the problem in general, isn't it? In our culture, that I mentioned the kind of balkanization of news and information, where, you know, liberals get their news from MSNBC and conservatives from Fox, yes, etc., and Christians from Christian broadcasting. Are we in danger of becoming a society where there is no consensus about what is true and what is real?
Well, it really worries me that we're moving to a tribalism that's abetted in large part by digital communications, that everyone is pulling back into their own echo chambers, and that the real danger that we have to be thinking about is the power of algorithms to support that. I think that's the next frontier for criticism by the media on what is happening with our society. A little bit that, you know, we saw the brouhaha over Facebook, where the right was complaining, but I think there's much more there that we should all be looking at. I don't quite know what the answers are, but that's exactly what I want to dedicate more of my own time to, because I think what it's doing is dividing our society and the world in ways that are dangerous.
And how do you feel about this kind of binary notion in journalism, where everything there's two black and white opinions in the entire universe of discourse? That it's, you know, so every time you have a Republican on, you have to have a Democrat, and the logic.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, clearly there's such a thing as as false equivalence. And Murrow himself had that huge fight inside CBS because at that time under federal regulations, television was under tremendous pressure to always show the two sides on everything. And we know that has continued too much to this day. But, you know, as the mainstream news media has less and less power or less and less influence over the American public, and the digital media becomes far more influential, I think that that more than the problem of false equivalence is the problem of these algorithms.
But obviously, it's had the effect of, you know, the ultimate absurdity would be if you interview a Holocaust survivor, you have to interview a Holocaust denier. Yeah, and that has led to creationism being equated with evolution. And it's led to, and it's allowed the denial of global warming, because after all, the deniers are simply the other side of it. And to some extent, it's probably going to enable Donald Trump, in the sense that he's the standard bearer of the other party. So to that extent, do you think he's going to get dignified simply because of the position he has, or will the media remind us of all the terrible things that he said and all the people who he's insulted?
That's a good question. I couldn't agree with you more about the problem. This is where I think that an effort by much of the mainstream news media to begin doing immediate fact-checking, including CNN did something I've seen the other day where they started running in the little ribbon while he was speaking, sort of trying to fact check him real time. I mean, you can imagine that's extraordinarily hard to do. But, you know, I think it's incumbent on all the media to try to correct the falsities that are said by Trump or by anybody, but he is particularly egregious in having just zero respect for the facts.
Well, just in the last minute, Edward, it would seem that from that retreat that Romney had on Friday, where Meg Whitman said that Trump reminded her of Hitler and Mussolini, when somebody in the audience said to Paul Ryan, who was extremely uncomfortable, would you please run? And the place, they all got to their feet and cheered. Do you think there's a possibility that Trump could withdraw and that a white knight like Paul Ryan could ride to the rescue for the Republicans?
No. I think this process is now going to have to play itself out. I think, you know, we court revolution if we now try to steal the Republican nomination from all those angry people who nominated Trump.
I mean, sure.
It would be a clear a fiat from above, and it would be very dangerous. I think now we have to see this thing through to the end.
Well, Edward Schumacher, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Schumacher Matos, who's the director of the Edward R. Murrow Center for a Digital World, a professor of digital media and public diplomacy at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and a global fellow at the Latin America program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's a former ombudsman for NPR and was part of a team to win the Pulitzer Prize at the Philadelphia Inquirer. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.